We're continuing with the story of the burning bush, the divine revelation to Moshe, in which God appointed Moshe to be the leader of the Jewish people. The mission entailed two aspects to it. One was to become the leader of the Jews. That is to prepare the Jews. As we said, they had become assimilated, and they needed leadership to return them back, so to speak, to the pathways of the fathers, and ultimately to receive the Torah. So that was the main aspect of his leadership, was towards the Jews. But the other aspect was to Paro. That was, I guess, what you'd call foreign policy, to deal with the ruler and to get him to let the Jews go. As we mentioned, the idea that he was leading a rebellion, that the Jews should be let free, that's not true. All he was asking for was opportunity to go a distance of 3 days and to sacrifice. That's the whole battle that ensues with the bringing down of the plagues and Paro's reluctance and refusal. All hinges around that. All revolves around that. It's an amazing thing to what a stubborn person Paro was, because Moshe was not asking that they be released from freedom. Anyways, just to review, when Hashem told this to Moshe, that the cries of the Jewish people had reached him, and now the time has come. So everybody knows that Moshe refused, demurred. Moshe, that's probably one of the most amazing things, that this type of a offer, it's hard to imagine anyone that we're familiar with, whether they're, you know, Jews or Gentiles, leaders, clergy, rabbis. It's hard to imagine a person just walking away from something like this. Yeah, the tremendous humbleness, which is the most important characteristic of a leader, is humbleness. And we haven't seen the likes of this type of a humbleness since that time. But basically, that's what Moshe says, that who am I? He has two objections. The one focuses on himself, that he's not qualified to be the leader. The second one, as we said, according to Rashi, was that, which is even more interesting perhaps, or disturbing, was that what is the merit of the Jews? By what merit do the Jews warrant divine intervention? So that's to say that, not that he was minimizing, that there's a tremendous injustice. We as people have an obligation to fight against injustice. It's a very interesting point. But does God have an obligation? I'm just using, you know, expressions. We have to be, so to speak. Does God, so to speak, we can't say that God has an obligation to do anything. But does God have an obligation to fight against injustice in the world? This is an interesting point. I'm not going to spend too much time on it. It's a discussion in its own right. Because that's what disturbs people when injustices take place. And then they blame it on God, and why doesn't God do something about it? It's not just a simple point. God does not always intervene. The real question is, why does man not do something about it? That's what I would say. That most of the suffering and the injustices that occur are man-made. Either it's man against man, wicked people against good people. Not to mention, in the ordinary course of life, I'm not talking about big injustices. The Rambam maintained that most of the suffering that people experience in life is self-induced. It's brought upon one way or another. They've brought it upon themselves by failing to take proper care of themselves, by making stupid decisions and things like that. But in terms of the world at large, when we're talking about suffering, destruction, that's man against man. And basically, that's the commandment of the Torah, that we have an obligation to fight against evil. People don't take this seriously enough. That's ultimately to destroy Amalek, so to speak. And the failure to do that and the tolerance of evil is one of the greatest crimes, according to Judaism, not according to the other religions. The other religions think it's a virtue to be tolerant and liberal and to let and to forgive and to turn the other cheek. Judaism maintains just the opposite, that is wickedness, that's evil, that's not even compassion, it's cruelty. And I would say that by, well, look, for thousands of years, the Jews weren't in any kind of power. We were just struggling for our own survival. But it's not something which is a popular idea. That this idea is not trumpeted. Even by Jews. Even by Jews, even by rabbis. They've kind of adopted, I think to a large extent, the Jews and Jewish theology has been influenced by non-Jewish theology. And I'm saying, I mean among not just Reform or Conservative, even Orthodox, to a large extent. So Moshe asked, Moshe himself believed in fighting against injustice. He intervened and he put his life on the line. And then he intervened again, even for non-Jews, the daughters of Yisro. But when God said he's coming to redeem the Jews, he wanted to know why. When do you, that's something else. When does God choose to intervene with divine providence is not a simple thing. Not a simple thing. It's a tremendous area. It's not something that anybody fully grasps. We do believe in divine providence. We're going to be celebrating Hanukkah. Miracle. Divine providence. But bear in mind, when did that providence come into play? After the Jews decided to do something about it. As long as the Jews didn't do anything about it, nothing was happening. So the idea that God will fight our battles for us is not a simple thing. We do believe that the divine assistance, you saw it in this week's Parsha, with the encounter between Yaakov and Esav. That's it's a paradigm for the relationship between the Jews and the anti-Semites. And that Yaakov was very afraid, but he wasn't paralyzed. And he prepared. He prayed. Prayer is very, very important. But he didn't rely just on prayer. He engaged even in diplomacy. Whatever he possibly could do. And then he prepared for war. Whoever he could save. So that's the classical response. That's emblematic of the Jewish response, is not passivity. Not passivity and not retreat and withdrawal purely into prayer per se. Those who say, we're just going to pray and God will take care of it, that's contrary to the philosophy of the Torah. Because God expects us to do that which we can do within reason. It's interesting to note that point. Nobody notices that the forefathers were warriors. Abraham was a warrior. He fought the war against the coalition of the four kings that conquered in order to save his nephew Lot. The Torah doesn't highlight that because we don't glorify war, but it's there. And you see in this week's Parsha, when they kidnapped Dinah, and then they had those negotiations under the seat, a lot of people are bothered by all of that. We had a discussion about that.
Are we really passive?
Throughout recent Jewish history, the Jews, by and large, if you want to use the term passive, not in every particular case. That was the exile. That was the punishment. Indeed, that was the punishment that God took away from us the ability to defend ourselves, and we were prey. It's hard to say. Had the idea been different even in the exile, had we sought to be more proactive and so on and so forth, I don't know. But that's not the ideal. The ideal of the Torah is for Jews to be capable of self-defense wherever possible. I think it's important. I mean, I tell people even today in the yeshivas, they should train. Everybody should train his children. The yeshiva should be trained how to defend yourself. Not to be aggressive, not to pick a fight. But if somebody starts up with you, to be able to fight back. That, in my opinion, is a very big mitzvah. So God's answer to that question, though, in terms of what makes the Jews worthy of redemption, was very, very cryptic. He said, when you take them out, they will worship me on this mountain. Which I take to mean that they aren't worthy. They aren't worthy right now. They haven't distinguished themselves. But they're going to become worthy by virtue of the fact that they will receive the Torah. And no other people, according to our tradition, would receive the Torah, would accept the Torah. So it's by virtue of that fact. It's a very, very important point. The whole essence of being Jewish, of the relationship between God and the Jews has to do with the fact that we are the people that accept the Torah. Accept the Torah, maintain the Torah, preserve the Torah, the preservation of the Torah. Indeed, that's what we say at the Haggadah. You know that. We said that to the wicked son, right, who denies the Torah, basically. Had you been there, you wouldn't have been redeemed. That is, we're not intrinsically deserving of redemption. But the redemption is because we have a mission, which is of tremendous significance, you know, in God's creation of the world, and that is to help to bring the world to perfection. Now, what happens next is very interesting, okay? And that is that this whole business about Moshe asking the name of God, and the Rambam and the Mohr has a whole chapter on that. Was that an appropriate question? And well, what does it mean by the name of God? That this was very, very important. And we also noticed, we didn't answer it, but we also noticed an ambivalence in that God then proceeds to give him to tell him this is the name that you should tell them. And actually God gives him two names. That's in verse 14. Which is a very hard sentence to translate. Many translations have it, I am that I am, something along those lines, whatever that means. We'll try to explain it just a little bit. And then he tells them to tell him that he's the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, that God associates his name only with these three people. And after that, God says to go to the elders and gather them and tell them that the God of their fathers has appeared to you and that he's remembered you and that which has been done to you. In other words, to basically to let them know that the time is coming for the redemption. Now, in verse 18, that's chapter 3, verse 18, God says that they will listen to your voice. So God is telling Moshe that they will listen to your voice. They'll listen to you. They'll believe you. Don't worry about it. And they will hear. And they will go with you to Paro. Obviously, if they didn't believe you, they wouldn't go with you to Paro. And make this request. Of course, that request will fail. Interesting, God's mapping everything out for him. Don't be disappointed. I want you to go through these steps, and basically they're not going to succeed until I enter the picture with the mighty hand. And then God also tells them about the, this is interesting, we'll come back to this perhaps tonight, that before they leave, that they will request all kinds of gifts from their Egyptian neighbors and that they will give, and they won't leave empty-handed. Okay. What's interesting, though, is bear in mind that Moshe wanted to be able to tell them God's name. And then that God said that they would believe you. But take a look at the beginning of chapter 4. Chapter 4, verse 1. In response to this, Moshe says, Vehein lo yaminu li, they won't believe me. And they won't listen to my voice. For they will say that God did not appear unto you. Now that's got to strike you as being very, very difficult, doesn't it? It sounds impudent on the surface. I say it sounds. That God has just told him that they will listen to you. And that they'll believe you and so on and so forth. How can Moshe retort by what is he, denying God? That's absurd. It doesn't make any sense. You can't argue with God on something like that. You can't disagree with God. Nevertheless, God doesn't rebuke him and God doesn't get angry with him. God simply asks him what he proceeds. He treats the question as a serious good point. He doesn't seem to be upset. And then God proceeds to give him the signs. The first one being the snake, the demonstration of the snake. The second one with the hand and the leprosy. And the third one, God says if they need another sign, we don't even know if they will need it or not, but God says, just in case, with the pouring of the water, and the water will turn into blood. So what's going on over here, though? I mean, who's right and who's wrong? Well, why is God indulging him, so to speak? God said, they'll listen to you. Now, is God changing his mind and agreeing with Moshe? What's going on over here? The Rambam has a chapter on this. Now, and this is the Friedlander edition, which is the paperback, English translation. So he takes up this question. In fact, he has a whole chapter dedicated to trying to explain the what's going on over here. And I'll just try and give you a brief review. He takes up this question that we've asked, that on the surface it seems that after God assures him that they will listen to you, he then proclaims that they won't listen to me. And then God gives him the miracles. So, I mean, if he needed miracles, God should have given the miracles right away. And so on. So he says there's two different issues over here at play. Notice that when God gives him the name, now we ask, what does it mean, the name? Is that just the name, something that you call something by? Is that the idea of the name? Well, he says no. The name is representative of the concept. What is the concept of God? And bear in mind, when it comes to the name, he was instructed to go to the elders. The elders means they're wise people, the chachamim of the Jewish people. That even in Egypt, even when the Jews basically assimilated and so forth, they still had, if you want to use the word rabbis, they still had the sages that knew the ideas, that remembered, that had the ideas that they'd received from Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and the generation of the leaders of the tribes that had come down. So when it came to the name, when he was going to go to them, they were going to question him, and what are you, some kind of a charlatan? Who are you? What is you telling us that God appeared to you? So explain to us the nature of God, the idea of God, the concept of God. In other words, do you have a primitive idea? Is it some kind of an idolatrous idea? They were going to check him out. You're going to the Jewish people. You're going to have to deal with the wise people. And they're going to want to know, well, what's your concept? They're going to give him a test. So that's what he wanted. When Moshe asked God, what is your name? He meant, how can I teach them? How can I prove your existence? What's the concept? What are we talking about over here? How do you want me to make you known to them? So he gave him two names. The second one we're more familiar with. That is to say, the God that was worshipped by Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The God who relates to people when they live in a certain kind of a way. Okay, fine. But the first idea is Ekiah, Asher Ekiah. Now, I am that I am. What does that mean? Let me just read to you a little bit from the guide as he explains this. He says, then God taught Moshe how to teach them and how to establish amongst them the belief in the existence of himself, namely by saying, Ekya Rasha Ekya. Okay? Now, Hebrew, I will be.
Is that Ekya or Eya? How is that?
The Ekya I am, who I am that I am. What does that mean? So he says that by saying Ekya Rasha Ekya, a name derived from the verb Haya, in the sense of existing. For the verb Haya denotes to be. And in Hebrew, no difference is made between the verbs to be and to exist. Okay, the principal point in this phrase, that the same word which denotes existence is repeated as an attribute. Okay? I am, I exist. Okay? And that is then qualified. I exist who exists. I exist, what does that mean, I exist who exists? The word Asha, that exists, corresponds, it's an incomplete noun that must be completed by another noun. It may be considered as the subject of the predicate which follows. The first noun which is to be described is Ekya. The second by which the first is described is likewise. So the noun is being described by the same word, the identical word, as if to show that the object which is to be described and the attribute by which it is described are in this case necessarily identical. It's a little bit complicated. This is therefore the expression of the idea that God exists, but not in the ordinary sense of the term. That is, he exists because he exists. The being whose existence is absolute. That's what it means to say. He doesn't exist by virtue of anything else, but it means that the existence is part of his very nature. I exist by virtue of the fact that I exist, which is not the case of anything else, because anything else exists by what? Requires an extraneous cause. Our existence, we don't exist by nature. We come into being, which means to say that our existence requires an extraneous cause. But God's existence is completely different. God exists by virtue of the fact that that's his essence. His essence is to exist. That's why we refer to it as the absolute existence. meaning he requires God did not come into being. As everything else that has existence only has existence by virtue of the fact that it had a cause. But God's existence has no cause. Okay. You see from this, at any event, and that's why God exists eternally, because it's his nature to exist. We do not exist eternally because it's not in our nature to exist. However, we do have the potential for eternal existence because God designed us in a manner and endowed us with the soul, which has the capability, the potentiality of eternal existence. So, at all events, you could see that it's not just the name, call me this or call me that. But the name is denoting our concept of God, of a supreme being whose existence is absolute. Okay? But the Rambam holds that it's more than that. The Rambam holds that the Torah doesn't describe every word, that God gave and provided him with the ability to prove this concept, to demonstrate this concept. Bear in mind also, when you read the Torah, even conversations, it's not giving you a full transcript. That's not the point. The Torah is not a history book. So it's giving you the gist. It's conveying the gist. And the gist is that Moshe Rabbeinu wanted to be able to speak to their wise people and to demonstrate with proofs, with logic, what the concept. If he could not pass that test, if they discerned him to be a charlatan, and how they would do, because he's really ignorant, he's just trying to become a priest, but he really can't explain, he doesn't have a deep grasp, then he would have been rejected. So that's what he says. The proof he was to give, so the Rambam is saying that God gave Moshe a proof, consisted in demonstrating that there is a being of absolute existence that has never been and never will be without existence. So that's a significant element in our concept of God. The reason Moshe could communicate it to them is because this is the teaching of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And that teaching had been passed down. Now, unfortunately, the nation in general had corrupted its way. But they were still amongst them the wise. When God said they will listen to your voice, God was saying they will be able to understand. And you'll convince them. You'll be successful. And they'll recognize that you do represent the true idea, which is akin to what they've received. And they will then regard you as a leader. That's what Hashem told Moshe. If that is the case, then the question is, how do we explain Moshe's retort? When he said, and they will not believe me. And then everything that follows with the miracles and so on and so forth. And I'm reading a little bit further. God thus showed Moses the proofs. You see, so the Rambam is saying that the Torah doesn't describe everything that's taking place. He's saying that God showed him the proofs by which his existence would be firmly established among the wise men of the people. Therefore, the explanation of the name is followed by the words, quote, go gather the elders of Israel, and by the assurance that the elders would understand what God had shown to him and would accept it, as is stated in the words, and they shall hearken to thy voice. Moshe was not coming merely to teach them about God, but the second part of it was to demonstrate to them that he was that God had sent them with a message, that he was a Navi, that he was a prophet, and that God had given them a specific assignment, specific task. Okay? So, should you believe somebody when he comes? What should be your response when somebody comes to you and tells you that they spoke to God? What would you do? How would you react if somebody claimed to be a prophet and God had spoken to him and God had told him to come and tell you that he wants you to do such and such? How should people respond to a claim of prophecy? It's an very interesting question, because it's not so simple. Throughout all of history, this has been a major, major issue.